We're spending the hour on Standing Rock, the Ocheti Shakowin encampment, and the protest of the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's a new anthology here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nearly 1,200-mile Dakota Access Pipeline is owned by Energy Transfer Partners. It's referred to as DAPL. It stretches from the oil fields of western North Dakota through South Dakota and Iowa, ultimately linking to other pipelines in Illinois. Now, in 2016, the people of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, they mobilized with people from across the world to stop this pipeline, to protect the water and the land, the human rights. Did you participate in the Standing Rock demonstrations? Did you support the movement from afar? Tell us about your experience. 800-642-1234. Jess Kieran Dillon is a co-editor of the book Standing with Standing Rock, Voices from the No DAPL Movement. She's an associate professor of global studies and anthropology at the New School in New York. Jess Kieran, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Liz Ellis is an assistant professor of history at New York University. Her essay in this anthology is titled Centering Sovereignty, How Standing Rock Changed the Conversation. Liz, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, Jess Kieran, let's start with you. Standing with Standing Rock is described as a movement within a movement. How were the demonstrations in 2016 part of a larger struggle for Indigenous rights and a part of something else that was going on?
So I would say that those of us that have been thinking about the significance of Standing Rock, and Liz, please jump in here since this is what your essay is actually about, position it within a much longer arc of Indigenous resistance and mobilization to colonialism and occupation that really began with the point of first contact and conquest. And so what is really important for us as co-editors of this book and as scholars and activists and organizers that are committed to Native movements for liberation and sovereignty is that people understand Standing Rock as building upon a very long history of Indigenous resistance that has taken many shapes and forms, and that this is a moment where a kind of resurgence and reigniting of the possibilities for a different kind of future became visible with the mobilization of various indigenous nations. It was a multinational movement and really drawing attention to ongoing conditions of colonial violence, ongoing resistance to that violence that takes form, takes the form of violence against Indigenous women and girls, environmental violence, violence around criminalization, policing, and militarization. So I think it's part of that entire legacy. But Liz, you should also speak to this.
Yeah. Liz, how do the demonstrations at Standing Rock compare historically to Indigenous resistance of the past?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that's really significant about this specific context is that Lakota, Dakota, Nakota people, folks who collectively are sometimes known as Sioux, have been fighting for this territory since the mid-19th century with the federal government. So this is part of this very long struggle that begins really in the 1850s in an engaged way, where Native people allied, they came together and they basically forced the federal government repeatedly to negotiate. Some of us are familiar with, the massacre at Wounded Knee, the Battle of Greasy Grass or Little Bighorn. All of these sets of 19th century conflicts are taking place on the same territory that Native people were fighting for sovereignty in the 19th century, in the 20th century. This is also happens to be geographically very close to the center of the American Indian movement in the 1970s, if you heard about the occupation of Wounded Knee there. So that basically this is fundamentally something new in terms of scale and in terms of the extensive networks and alliances that Native people built. But this specific context is both part of a really long-going fight between Dakota and Nakota and Nakota people and the federal government over the ability to protect their lands, their waters, their territories, and their community. And then it's also, sort of a new era of this fight. But I think, to the question that Jess Skirin had started to answer, basically, there's been Indigenous movements for sovereignty, resurgence, and revitalization throughout the 20th century. And I think that because of social media, this one and Idle No More in Canada, which sort of directly preceded this mobilization, have gotten much more attention because Native people became visible by using digital media in a way that many of the fights that our people have been fighting throughout the 20th century and for long before that weren't sort of immediately visible to the public.
And we're going to talk more about the social media and about the youth voice in this. Liz Ellis is an assistant professor of history at New York University. She wrote an essay for this collection. And Jess Kieran Dillon is co-editor of the book Standing with Standing Rock, Voices from the No Dapple Movement. You can join in 800-642-1234. Did you participate in the Standing Rock demonstrations? Do you support the movement from afar? What did you feel about the time that these demonstrations were going on? Call in. You can reflect by email at ideas@wpr.org. Jess Kieran, Standing Rock demonstrators refer to themselves as water protectors. Can you explain the significance of that name?
Yeah. So I think part of the significance of classifying the movement and the people that are really on the ground doing the frontline land and water defense as water protectors was a response to the sort of ongoing depictions of indigenous peoples engaged in resistance movements and mobilizing against ongoing colonial violence as violent, as criminal, as protesters. Water protectors shifts the way one thinks about what it means to actually be on the land that historically has belonged to your people, that has a very long history, that holds with your people, that holds stories of your people, that holds ceremonies for your people. I think it raises a different set of questions about why people were organizing and mobilizing and creating these encampments in order to protect the Minnesota or the Missouri River. And so I think it's a deliberate move to push back against those very, I would say, stereotypical dominant portrayals of indigenous people as sort of, again, organizing another protest to raise issues with the federal and state governments around various things. It really makes one think about the relationship between indigenous sovereignty and environmental justice, which I think is also a really significant component of this movement and the work that it does.
Let's bring in Jan now in Luck. Hi, Jan.
Hello. Hi.
What is your memory?
I have friends that are from Texas, but they're Lakota, and they were there. Her husband actually worked on the cleanup, does cleanup for oil spills, and they were protesting, and due to the chemicals that were thrown at them, my friend had respiratory problems before. Now she's in a wheelchair. That was from the police force that was there. There were chemicals that were thrown at them. I don't understand why, when this is their land, they constantly have to fight for it. It ought to be looked at as if it were their own state instead of always having to fight for their land. Oil companies should be getting permission from them. They shouldn't have to fight.
Jan,
to keep what was already theirs.
Yeah, Jan, thank you so much for bringing that contribution. We are spending the hour with the new anthology. It's called Standing with Standing Rock. Liz Ellis is an assistant professor of history at New York University. She contributed an essay. Jess Kieran Dillon is co-editor of the book and a first-generation anti-colonial scholar and anthropologist at the New School. What did you learn? What did you feel as the demonstrations at Standing Rock took place? Did you notice a change in media coverage surrounding Standing Rock? How do you think energy companies should interact with the land? Join in at 800-642-1234. There's more conversation about the No Dapple movement in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, we're spending the hour with a new anthology about Standing Rock. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In 2016, one of the largest indigenous resistance movements protesting an oil pipeline took place at the Standing Rock Reservation. 3 years later, we're looking at the No Dapple movement through a collection of essays. It includes the voice of 15-year-old Daisha Grinnell. She said, "I saw the lands that I had grown up on getting destroyed little by little, drill by drill. When Mother Earth comes crashing down, will the money matter?" The anthology is called Standing with Standing Rock. Your thoughts welcome, 800-642-1234. New York University historian Liz Ellis wrote an essay for the collection. The New School anthropologist Jess Kieran Dillon is a co-editor of the book. She's also the author of Prairie Rising, and they stay with us from New York. Liz, can we talk about your personal experience? As we heard the caller, Jan, comment, people were hurt in these protests, in these demonstrations. What was your experience with the movement 3 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to respond to something Jan said that I think is super important, and that's that there is separate jurisdiction for Native nations, Native territories, so that basically, because the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people have a series of treaties that defend the land that they're on, they really should be seen as foreign sovereign nations with exclusive control over their territories and rights. And what's really interesting about the Sioux-specific context here is that the federal government found in a series of court cases in the 20th century that they didn't have proper title to a lot of the lands that the pipeline goes through today and that the federal government has since removed Native people from. So this is not just about, environmental concerns, but there's a really major series of stakes about sovereign territory going on here that I think sometimes gets overlooked. In terms of my experience, one of the things that was – I was organizing in Philadelphia. I was not on the front lines of Standing Rock. And I think one of the things that was really remarkable was the way in which this movement generated important intersectional solidarity so that people who were from working class backgrounds, folks who are from communities of color in Philadelphia who've been dealing with air contamination from nearby industrial plants, who've been dealing with the same kinds of issues of water contamination like folks at Flint are facing, automatically understood the stakes of this fight and the way in which sort of climate contamination, climate degradation hits vulnerable communities, impoverished communities, and communities of color in many ways the hardest in this country. So there was sort of a natural series of alliances. And I think what was really remarkable was people who hadn't necessarily previously organized around indigenous issues understood the stakes of this fight very clearly. And so there was this really remarkable intersection of folks who were working sort of on local climate issues, people who were organizing for, more ethical urban development. This is, again, Philadelphia specific. Mm-hmm. And then folks who, were with faith-based organizations who were concerned about the level of violence being unleashed on Native people at Standing Rock. There was a really remarkable coalition building thing that happened as the result of this.
Jess Kieran, if you're willing to share, what was your experience with the movement in 2016?
I'm happy to share that. So I was actually on the front lines at Standing Rock several times with some of my comrades, including Nick Estes, who's the co-editor, one of the co-editors or other co-editor with along with me of this book. So I just want to, acknowledge that. So we were also on the front lines. And then I also did a lot of organizing in New York City around raising awareness about the pipeline, mobilizing universities, developing teach-ins, helping to support the creation of the Standing Rock Syllabus Project, which allowed people to have access to a body of knowledge that helped to historicize and contextualize the movement at Standing Rock in important ways. But I can speak a little bit about my experience of arriving at Standing Rock in the camps. I would say that one of the most glaring and striking things to me was the intense militarization and police and legal presence that was there as soon as you got close to the reservation and to the grounds of where all of the camps were being established. So I was there for the first time early on in August of 2016, and there were barricades, there was barbed wire. They had cut off access from on the main highway from Bismarck to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. And so you had to take this long circuitous route. There were more military and armed guards than I'd ever seen at any other protest. And then my subsequent visits only reconfirmed the kind of violent and militarization and criminalization of the water protectors that was being advanced by various levels of government alongside the private mercenary firm that was hired by Energy Transfer Partners, Tiger Swan. So alongside that, though,
Tiger Swan, as in the book we learn, had a real connection to, being able to take down militant situations in other countries.
Yeah, absolutely. So they have locations in numerous countries around the world and are a private mercenary firm whose work is actually centered on quelling political resistance. And so this was the firm that was hired by Energy Transfer Partners to quell the resistance at Standing Rock simultaneously. But I just want to add that alongside that presence was also an incredible and breathtaking and immensely beautiful and an inspiring mobilization of Indigenous nations like nothing I have ever been able to witness in Native North America before. And so that also gave one a sense of a kind of future visioning of what is possible, a brief moment to see what our world could look like, a push back against individualism and assertion of a kind of collective responsibility to one another and to the land. And so there were all of these things that emerged in the process of mobilization that I think are incredibly important. And some of that is obviously documented in the anthology. This real sort of moment to actually step back and to think about the world that we all participate in and the kind of world that may be possible if we step out of the sort of the structures of capitalism and colonialism and really think about what it means to live in a good way with one another and the world around us.
We're talking about the new anthology, Standing with Standing Rock, Voices from the No DAPL Movement. With your thoughts along the way, we're talking with Jess Kieran Dillon. She's an associate professor of global studies and anthropology at the New School, co-editor. Liz Ellis studies early American history and Native American history at New York University and has a contribution to the anthology. You can join in 800-642-1234. How do you think private energy companies should interact with the land? Do you think the government should protect their interests? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's look at the youth movement here for a moment. Jess Kieran, you interviewed Daisha Grinnell in 2016. She was this 15-year-old activist involved with the No DAPL movement. What influenced her activism?
Part of what influenced her activism, I think, is watching. Zaysha is from the Fort Berthold Reservation. And so part of her activism and mobilization around DAPL was seeing the way that the development of that infrastructure, oil infrastructure project, changed her homelands. Not only the physical components of her homelands, but also the social and political ways in which her community are able to live in relationship to that land. And so she, in the interview that I conducted with her, you know, she talked about the sort of intergenerational struggles to maintain that land and to take care of that land and the histories of her people that are held within that land. And then also how the sort of development of the Bakken oil fields and the man camps have created heightened levels of violence against Indigenous women and girls, and the kind of fear that young people like her have to carry with them when they're walking on their homelands and, you know, on their home territories because of this, the incursion and the heightened levels of colonial gender violence that come alongside extractive projects like the oil fields.
Liz, yeah, go ahead. What about the role of young people played, you know, how it's played out in the No DAPL movement?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really amazing about this movement is the diversity, the generational and the gender diversity of folks who participated. I think a lot of the time when we think about Indigenous resistance movements, if we think back to the 18th or the 19th century, we think of Blue Jacket, Little Turtle, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse. We think of men at the head of these movements. And one of the things that's really remarkable, again, about Native people being able to sort of tell their stories themselves is we were able to see all of the energy of women, children, and elders in this movement. So I'm thinking of folks like Bobby Jean Three Legs, who organized a youth run all the way from Standing Rock to D.C., where they sort of, you know, relay ran this entire distance in order to bring attention to the movement. I'm thinking of folks like Dallas Goldtooth and Candy Mossett and, you know, young teenagers who I think not only, you know, really helped to generate a lot of the enthusiasm for this movement, but it's so important for young Native kids to see sort of heroes, to see people who can be celebrated within their culture. As, you know, y'all likely know, youth suicide rates are super high, so this moment of resurgence and the ability of Native people to organize, to develop these exciting transnational conversations really galvanized a generation.
The book is called Standing with Standing Rock. Co-editor Jess Kieran Dillon, essayist for the collection Liz Ellis, they're here. Did you take part in Standing Rock? Did you support the movement from afar? What did you learn? What did you feel as the demonstrations took place? 800-642-1234. Back with more conversation right after this news update on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, who captured the world's attention in 2016. The new anthology out of University of Minnesota Press is called Standing with Standing Rock. One of the voices in this book is LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, a Lakota activist and historian of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Her words here: they took our footprint out of the ground, and who has the right to do that? 3 years ago this month, water cannons blasted her sacred stone encampment. A protester describes the scene to The Guardian.
I've been tearing gas multiple times tonight. It's painful. You're choking. You're throwing up. It takes you a long time to recover.
How do you think private energy companies should interact with the land? Is there a balance to be found between energy needs and tribal rights? Join in at 800-642-1234. The New School anthropologist Jess Kieran Dillon and New York University historian of Native American history Liz Ellis both contributed to this new anthology, Standing with Standing Rock, and they stay with us from New York. Liz, how did the leaders of the No Dapple movement use social media to build support? What impact did hashtags make?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that's really significant here is that the leaders of this movement drew on the strategies of both Black Lives Matter, of Idle No More, and of this, you know, sort of emerging indigenous Twitter series of conversations that are really terrific. I think what's so important about this is that frequently, even today, we imagine that most Native people live in the distant past, or that they're dead, or that there's not very many, quote, you know, real Indians, real indigenous people around. And so what the control of social media by Native folks on the front lines did was it let people tell their own stories and present themselves. I mean, this may sound silly, but as contemporary humans who wear jeans and sweaters, who look like you or I, who come in all different shades. And so to be able to have Native people tell their own stories, document what was happening on the front lines. I remember seeing a lot of the coverage of this violence, right, of dogs attacking, you know, this private security forum setting attack dogs on people who had come to defend the graves of their ancestors, of seeing the water cannon, of seeing, you know, rubber bullets and the militarized police presence on the feeds of Native people and through Twitter. And so I think that was a really important, the hashtag No Dapple movement was a way to get out a side of the story and a side of indigenous resistance that typically has not been covered in sort of mainstream media. And I think that really changed the conversation and let Native people tell the kinds of stories, give the kinds of perspectives, and emphasize why it is that they were so invested in this fight.
Jess Kieran, how did garnering support through the media, you know, change the conversation about Indigenous resistance and treaty rights? Because, you know, the media didn't always get it right either.
Yeah, no, the media rarely gets it right, I would say. But I do think, just to sort of follow up on some of the commentary that Liz just offered, which I think is such an excellent overview of why it matters so much for Indigenous people to be able to represent themselves and share their stories and kind of the essence of what their movements are about, is that the attention and focus on Standing Rock, I think, raised awareness of the movements for Native liberation and sovereignty that many people in the United States either do not know about or are engaged in the sort of systematic suppression of. So for me, it actually opened up a whole opportunity to create a kind of series of public awareness campaigns, to develop courses on these things, to bring people in from other parts of the country to lecture at the New School, so that it created a kind of momentum in raising a kind of public profile and awareness of, as Liz mentioned, that these are contemporary struggles for land reclamation, for revitalization, for resurgence, and they have actually existed since the country that we know as the United States has come into being, and that the government that actually, you know, the formal political governance system in the United States is actually viewed as illegitimate by Indigenous nations who claim sovereignty over their homelands, and the assertion of the treaty rights that were clearly outlined in the numerous treaties that were signed between the state and Indigenous people. So I think the media helped to sort of raise that kind of contemporary awareness, but also it was very important that there were so many different kinds of representations that were coming forward to counteract the kind of dominant stereotypical narratives about Indigenous people that are so prevalent in the majority of media that's consumed by everyday people.
And so many different perspectives. When I, you know, with this new anthology, you have 40 contributors through essays and poetry and, you know, photography, and so many voices who we haven't heard from. What was that like to curate this collection?
I think it was the sort of part of the broader goal in curating this collection was to really foreground the writing and experiences and stories of Lakota and Dakota scholars and non-academic contributors whose work is often excluded from edited collections like this one. And there's a long history of a deep set of problematics associated with academic knowledge production. And one of the things that Nick and I tried to do with this book is to really push back against the kind of colonial depictions of Indigenous peoples and to create a space for Native people that were involved with this movement to be able to narrate their experience from their own vantage points and to provide access to a range of interpretations of the movement and to create a kind of a collection that could be used in university classrooms, but accessible enough that could be used in secondary schools and community settings and also on the front lines of a resistance camp like the one at Standing Rock.
Liz, you were going to jump in there. Your thoughts as we were talking about the media attention to these demonstrations and the movement, as we saw what was happening to protesters, what did you see beyond that? How and why did this become, you know, such a dangerous environment?
I think one of the things that the media sort of really that happened with the coverage of Standing Rock was we went from an initial series of focuses on the rights of Native people to defend land, to defend water, to sort of draw on these what are frequently tropes that the mainstream public has of Native people as, you know, in sort of harmony with the environment, and Native people being able to tell their own stories and to kind of control their own media really shifted this conversation to focusing on these questions of sovereignty, to focusing on these questions of treaty rights. And so to say not only that, like, it's reprehensible that the federal government, I mean, and honestly, North Dakota taxpayers, right? There are millions and millions of dollars of North Dakota tax-funded taxpayer money that was driven to police and protect this private oil project.
About $38 million?
Yeah, that's correct, right? And so this is stuff, the question there of, does that actually benefit folks in North Dakota to subsidize private oil companies as opposed to investing in other kinds of sustainable infrastructure, other kinds of public development? But that basically this conversation and the ability to show the violence, to focus on the treaties, and to make folks aware of the way in which the federal government was failing to protect not just Indigenous people's interests, but sort of all folks who would be impacted by the possible contamination of the Missouri River, I think was really important. And I just want to flag that there's just a series of reporting yesterday on all of the leaking of the Keystone pipeline that's currently ongoing that I think sort of, you know, solidifies a lot of the concerns that environmental protection folks have had for a long time about the danger of running pipelines under rivers and water supplies.
We're talking with Liz Ellis, a Native American historian and a citizen of the Peoria Tribe of Indians of Oklahoma. Jess Kieran Dillon is an anti-colonial scholar and organizer. She grew up on Treaty 6 Cree territory. You can join in 800-642-1234. What do you want to say about Standing Rock? How did the No DAPL movement change you? Jess Kieran, how do federal and state governments, by protecting private energy interests, how does that threaten the Indigenous way of life today?
Well, I think that one can sort of look back at the development of infrastructure projects of various kinds, including damming projects along the Missouri River, as part of the way the United States established itself as a settler colony and developed an economic structure that would support a certain kind of relationship to land, water, and air, and also consumption of what the government refers to as natural resources. So I think this is about thinking hard about what it means to engage in the process of capitalist accumulation to the extent that it has detrimental and devastating impacts on our physical, social, spiritual, and political well-being. And so I think that when I think about the work of and the ongoing violence enacted by federal and state governments in relationship to Indigenous peoples who assert a very different kind of governance, political governance authority over their land and relationship to the world around them, I think of the deep epistemological and ontological differences that you have, right, in the creation of a state that is actually centered on extractivism, exploitation, and the advancement of a kind of settlement that benefits a very particular group of people. So I think, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think sometimes this gets framed as an Indigenous people versus development conversation, which is not quite right. I think one of the things about specifically this, the fight over Standing Rock that's really important is this pipeline was initially routed to go just north of Bismarck, North Dakota. And that pipeline got rerouted because the commissioners of the city, the citizens of Bismarck, were really concerned about the potential for leaking and other kinds of damage. And so it was rerouted south. But I think that there are other avenues for mutual development and sort of mutual critical infrastructures that Native people and the federal government can develop together.
Liz Ellis and Jess Kieran Dillon, they're introducing us to some of the 40 voices who contributed to this new anthology called Standing with Standing Rock. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for an hour-long conversation about the new book, Standing with Standing Rock, on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the protests in North Dakota and the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, DAPL, led by the Standing Rock Sioux. And the pipeline became officially operational in mid-2017. Today, more than 500,000 barrels of crude flow through it every day. Join in 800-642-1234. Liz Ellis wrote an essay for the collection titled Centering Sovereignty. Anthropologist at the New School, Jess Kieran Dillon, is co-editor of the book. They stay with us from New York. Let's go to the phones now. Dina is joining us from Ontario. Hi, Dina.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, first I want to thank you for having this show and for the anthology. because what happened at Standing Rock was a pivotal moment. It wasn't the first, and I'm sure it won't be the last. And obviously, a lot of things have come from it. And I went because of the prayers. I went and I stayed because of the prayers. And I returned to the end because of the prayers. The prayers for all of humanity. And I think it was said earlier, for what we could be, what we could become. we all need to look at the earth differently. My biggest concern for calling was, it's nice that this show is happening now, but when everything was happening, when the water cannons were happening, and even when the end, when there were multiple media represented at the close of Standing Rock, when they, you know, basically wiped out the camp, there was very little media coverage that actually got through to people. And I think people need to demand more and better coverage, and from many sources. And a lot of people fault social media, but I agree with what was said earlier that it wasn't for social media, very little would have been heard by what happened there. So I just wanted to say thank you, and I would go back in a heartbeat for all of it, for the struggle that it was. The beauty that was there was immense.
Beauty of humanity. Dina, thank you for your words. Kevin now in Viroqua. Kevin, hi, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for putting this show on. And I too, like Dina, was up at Standing Rock, and I was in the right place at the right time on the night that everything happened on the bridge. And it was alarming to see what the media said versus what was truly happening. And that's kind of continued since with the laws that have been coming out, particularly around pipelines and energy. But these lines go through stolen land to start with. And now we're looking to be able to criminalize people who merely want to stand and make a point peacefully that they shouldn't be there and that there's a better way. And now they're looking at federal prison sentences simply for alleged trespass on energy resources.
Well, Kevin, I want to pause right there because several states across the country, including Wisconsin, have pursued more stringent laws related to trespassing or damaging oil pipelines. Liz, why do you oppose legislation like this?
I think one of the things that's so dangerous about this, I mean, it's not just free speech conversations, but I think that we need to understand the current movement for climate justice, right, for people to say, let's think about how many plane flights we're taking or how much meat we're eating or, you know, altering our lives. This is a critical part of the fight for livable futures for everyone. Again, you know, this fight is centered on Native people, on Native defensive environment, but these are much, much larger issues, right? The folks at Standing Rock were defending a river that provides drinking water for 8 million Americans. And so I think it's really important to understand these not as specific local issues, but as part of this larger movement. And Joss might be able to speak more effectively to this, but about how this is a critical part of the fight going forward to ensure that we all have the ability to have clean drinking water in coming years.
Yeah, Joss, go ahead.
So I would say that, you know, I think these legislation forms of legislation and policy that are being developed in order to protect energy companies, again, they're part of a much longer history of a focus on extractive projects as a way to fuel a particular kind of economic structure. And I would say that railroads, gold mines, oil pipelines, anything that is sort of established to support this kind of economic development and the creation of a kind of ability to extract resources, what gets termed as resources, without any consideration for the cost, is part of the historical development of this country. And so for me, like Liz, I feel like the intersection between The movement against a particular pipeline and the broader questions of climate justice are absolutely urgent and essential and paramount for all of us across the globe to consider. And I think that's, again, one of the significant contributions that this movement made, is that it does defy purely localized analysis. It does make connections between people that are fighting in the Amazon to protect the rainforest, between, you know, young people that are organizing in the northeastern section of Cambodia to protect the jungle. It makes the connections across the globe around what is actually at stake.
I think one of the things that's key here, too, is Native people aren't anti-development. We're just anti certain kinds of development. I'm thinking about, like, on White Earth, there's all these efforts to use technology to develop solar so that people are on self-sustainable reservations, right? There's efforts to revive rice, to revive traditional kinds of crops that will help prevent climate erosion. There's all sorts of really exciting efforts ongoing. So it's not so much just against a pipeline as for a kind of future that makes sense and that will be sustainable.
Let's bring in Erin now in Fountain City. Hi, Erin.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Like many other callers, I was out at Standing Rock. I started my first trip out there was in August, and I remember just seeing the fields wide open and camp near the Cannonball, and come October, November, the camp just... The amount of people that came together, like a previous caller said, was absolutely beautiful to see the cooperation, to see the diversity there. Unbelievable. It's not something that I've seen in my lifetime, that many people coming together to protect our future, our water. But then, like our guests here have said, this isn't just a local issue. The impacts that rippled across the nation. Right now, Wisconsin's considering an assembly bill and Senate bill that would felonize protesting these energy infrastructure projects. So I know as the host, you asked, should our government be funding or protecting the corporate interests? My answer is absolutely not, because the corporations have no interest in our vitality or livelihood long term. They're in it for the dollar, and we have to protect the generations that come after us. And again, to echo a previous caller, I would go back in a heartbeat.
Erin, thank you for your words. Jess Kieran, you and your fellow editor are often asked about where you find hope. Why do you think you get that question, and where do you find hope? Where do you find that answer?
Yeah, we do get that question. And I think part of the answer to that, or my response to that, is I find hope in the places that, you know, Liz just articulated about the kinds of mobilizations and creation of different ways of thinking about what it means to engage in a process of quote unquote development that is not structured on extractivism and exploitation. And I also think that there are instances and moments like the one at Standing Rock that exist all over the planet. And so I think we don't often think or see the sort of what how people are organizing in other parts of the world because of our limited access to stories about these kinds of mobilizations. But, you know, I think that it is a moment in the world where people are really standing up and organizing with whatever means they have access to be able to assert a kind of future for the planet and themselves, and to be able to create a different kind of idea about what might be possible if we think about what it means to live in a different way.
Jess Kieran, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And Liz Ellis, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
They are part of a new collection called Standing with Standing Rock, Voices from the No DAPL Movement. Coming up, we're learning how to appreciate art as a novice and where to scope out installations across the state. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.